It's good to see everyone out this morning. I want to thank the elders for the opportunity to preach this morning in Jack's absence. If you're visiting with us this morning, I want you to know you're welcome and an honored guest at any time. We'd love to study with you about what it means to be a Christian and to live for Jesus Christ. And thank you, John, for those songs. This morning, I'd like to talk about the subject of the good life. Even though many of us sometimes in our lives, we will face tragedies from time to time throughout our lives. And I had Jack Barrett read chapter 9 and like to reread verses 7 through 12 for a moment just to refresh your minds, and then we'll talk about the good life. Verse 7 says, "Go eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. Let your garments always be white and your head lack no oil. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which he has given you under the sun, all the days of vanity, for that is your portion in life, and in the labor which you perform under the sun. And whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all of your might, for there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave to which you are going. And I returned and I saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor is the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill, but time and chance happen to them all. And man does not know his time, like fish caught in a cruel net, like birds caught in a snare, so the sons of men are snared in an evil time when it falls suddenly upon them." I've got it turned on. Let me try it again. Let me know. Is that good? Okay, thank you, Stan. They're waving in the back, frantically in the back. What is the good life? You know, for many people, it's the pursuit of things or the pursuit of possessions. There was an old bumper sticker many years ago when I was younger. It said, "He who dies with the most toys wins." Queen Elizabeth I, Queen of England, is said to have said on her deathbed, quote, "All my possessions for just a moment of time." You know, sometimes when death is staring a person in the face, things are put back into proper perspective and we're able to define our lives in ways that are more from God's perspective than that of our own as we reflect on the lives we've lived and how we have lived them. And I think only then do we really see what life is really about. So my first question for you this morning is, how do you define your life? How do you define your life? And that's a big question. Many people would answer that question, well, they'd say, well, it's what I've done with my life, or it's the things that I've acquired. Well, I'm not totally opposed to that definition of a life, but let's take it just a step further and look at the bigger picture. Let's look at not only the physical implications, but as well as the spiritual parameters of that question as well. What do you have spiritually? What kind of treasures have you laid up in heaven as Jesus told us to do? You know, Jesus spoke of treasures in heaven back in Luke chapter 12 and verse 33. And so a question I have to you, have you built your house on shifting sands of human need and human greed, or have you built your house on the rock that will never fail? What are the most important goals in your life? What are the most important goals you have in this life? As you look on the emphasis of what it is that you're trying to attain, is it more on the physical side or is it more on the spiritual side? You know, a certain man came to Jesus in that same chapter, Luke chapter 12. I like to read a passage here, verse number 13 of Luke 12. The man says, "And then one from the crowd said to him, 'Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me.'" And Jesus' response in verse number 14 was very interesting. And he said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or an arbitrator over you?" Now Jesus' response was, this arbitrator or a judge is much like an agent who represents a professional athlete in this day and age, who stands between the baseball owner of a team and the baseball player, and that agent will negotiate a deal between them, and he charges a great commission for doing that.
Jesus said, I refuse to play the part of agent or administrator between you and your brother. And then he hits to the very root of the problem as he begins in verse number 15, and it's addressed their society, the people he was talking to at the time, and ours as well. Let's look down at verse number 15. Jesus says, and he says to them, take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things that he possesses. And then he goes on and tells us a parable beginning in verse number 16. And I'd like to read that parable and we'll discuss many things about it, starting in verse 16. Then he spoke a parable to them, saying, the ground of a certain rich man yielded plentifully. And he thought within himself, saying, what shall I do, since I have no room to store my crops? And he said, I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build greater, and there I will store my crops for my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, you fool, this night your soul will be required of you, and then whose will those things be which you have provided for? So is he who lays up treasure for himself, not rich towards God. Jesus again in verse 34 of this same chapter says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Treasure? What are the most important things in your life? Are they in building barns, as this man describes in the parable in this life, or are they in laying up treasures for the life to come? When you take stock of inventory, do you do as this man did? I want you to notice this man in the parable, he had a problem. And you can tell just by looking at the pronouns he uses. In verse 17, he talks about, I will do this, and my goods, and my barns, and I will lay down, and I will do this. He had a problem, and the problem was that he was selfish. And when he takes inventory of his possessions, and I quote this, as if they were his, he leaves God out of the picture. He leaves the source of all these blessings completely out of the picture. And that was the point Jesus was trying to make. This reminds me many years ago of Mike Schmidt. Many of you who are baseball fans will probably remember him with the Phillies. Mike was a phenomenal athlete and a baseball player. And he would do a number of commercials appealing to the drug addicts that they should leave their drugs. And instead, Mike said that he looked at himself and his own ability to get him through life. But where's Mike Schmidt now? He's not playing ball anymore, and he certainly isn't the athlete he used to be. And that's how people in our society look, and that's how this man looked in Luke chapter 12 as well. The first realization to living the good life, according to our text back in Ecclesiastes 9, is to first of all realize that our life is not in our hands. Our life is in someone else's hands. And chapter 9 in verse 1 talks about that, and we will look at that right now. And the scripture here tells us that anything awaits us. Anything awaits us? You bet. Let's look at verse 1. Chapter 9, for Solomon says, I considered all of this in my heart, so that I declare it all, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. And people know neither love nor hatred, so anything awaits us. That's the New American Standard Version. Anything awaits us? You bet. It's in God's hands. You know, there's a myth in modern day Americana that you can do anything and you can be anybody, and that you, through your strength, your potential is boundless. And the end result of that myth, combined with leaving God either in or out of the picture of your life, is often complete and total despair when our expectations do not happen. People sometimes combine this myth with the premise that, well, if I've got God in my life, I can be somebody more in terms of the way the world looks on people. And that doesn't always happen either. The end result of this over a very, very long time in one's life, or even a short time, is the kind of total despair that Solomon experiences as he starts looking in the book of Ecclesiastes, trying to figure out what is life all about. Now, what Solomon does in the book of Ecclesiastes, he often takes God and places God on a shelf. And he puts God to the side for a little while, and then he looks for meaning and happiness to life without God in the picture. And he looks for the definition of what life is all about. And he looks at a number of areas as you read through that book. He looks at sensual pleasure, many wives. He looks at things, material possessions. He looks at gardens. He looks at building parks and buildings and structures. He looks at wisdom. He looks at educational attainment. He looks at wine and drink. He looks at power and position and prestige and all of these other human pursuits that leave a person empty and full of despair. So full of despair that if you glance back at Ecclesiastes chapter 1, look at verses 14 and 15. He says, all the works that are done, cannot be numbered. Here's a man that's very full of despair. And he's so full of despair, if you look over just one chapter, in chapter 2 and verse 17, he says, so I hated life. Now this man, unlike many of us, grew up with some very religious training. He had a very deeply spiritual father, King David. And I say this because it gives me a little bit different perspective on Ecclesiastes that I might usually take. I think the book of Ecclesiastes is a book for every man. And everybody can relate to these pages because everybody goes through some of these same mental processes as Solomon does. And I don't know if Solomon, when he says, I hated life, I don't know if he was seriously talking about being suicidal. Maybe he wasn't. But he never forgot he was raised with those religious principles of having King David as his father. And what he does throughout the book as he's searching and groping in these various avenues of human pursuit, once in a while he'll take God back off the shelf and put God back in his life, much like we do. And even though the book of Ecclesiastes is very practical for general consumption by most people in the world, it's a very, very, very good practical lesson for those of us that are Christians, even those who were raised with the knowledge of God. And that brings us to our next point, because anything does await us. And that point is, what's next? You know, we grow up, and I remember sitting on my grandfather's lap as he drove an International Harvester under the sun in the fields in Indiana. And I used to think, boy, it would sure be nice to have a tractor. And then I couldn't wait till I got my driver's license. And we do this. We do this our whole life. What's next? We begin to ask ourselves throughout our life, what's next? You know, we grow up and we want to establish a career or a job, for instance. And we finally get that job and that career. And then we ask ourselves the question, what's next? We get ourselves a husband or a wife. And then we ask, well, what's next? We get ourselves a home, a house, and we ask ourselves, what's next? And we buy that certain kind of car that we've always dreamed about, and then we ask ourselves, what's next? And we get ourselves promoted to the position in that job that we always wanted to be promoted to. And we ask ourselves, what's next? And you know what, folks? There comes a point in a person's life when he's through asking the question, what's next? And he begins to say, vanity of vanity. Everything is vanity, says the preacher. What's next? You know, preachers aren't immune from this either. In fact, I suspect that one of the reasons so many preachers quit preaching, or one of the reasons that so many preachers move on to another city when they don't absolutely have to move, is because they're asking themselves the question, what's next? One of the reasons why so many mothers who ought to be in the home raising their children in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord want to establish a professional career because of those attractions and those external attractions and those allurements and motivations that are asking themselves, what's next? There's got to be something more than staying at home with these screaming kids. Or the man who reaches that midlife crisis that we all hear about, and he starts asking himself and wondering about all the things that he hasn't done and things he needs to get done, and he needs to get them done right now, is asking himself, what's next? You see, there are limitations to human existence. And Solomon was raised, like many of us were raised, with some very religious teachings. And we so often, like him, will take God off the shelf and put him to the side for a little while as we start searching for happiness in life, and we're looking in all the wrong places. You know, we will say all the right things to people when we talk to them and say, well, yes, you've got to have God in your life, but we look in all the wrong places for answers, and nevertheless, at the same time, we're hypocrites in that regard. You know, we're chasing an elusive dream that Solomon says is nothing but vapor. And the thing that made Solomon's despair so intense and the reason he began to hate life was the realization that there are limitations to human existence. You say you don't believe there are limits to human existence? You say you can do anything? You say you can be anybody? Let me tell you something. Solomon tried everything. Ask the rich man from Luke 12. The rich man said, I'm going to tear down my barns and I'm going to build greater. And the Lord said, this your soul is required. Yes, there are limitations to human existence. And the one ultimate limitation is death. And Ecclesiastes chapter 9 talks about it. Let's go back to our text this morning. Ecclesiastes says in chapter 9 and verse 1, let's repeat this. I considered all this in my heart, and I declared all that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God, and people know neither love nor hatred, for anything awaits him. Our lives are in the hand of God. And that one ultimate limitation is death. And we're all in the hand of God, and man does not know what awaits him because anything awaits us. Let's read verses 2 through 6 of this great text. Everything occurs alike to all. One event happens to the righteous and to the good and the clean and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. As so is the sinner, and so is he who takes an oath, and so is he who fears an oath. This is the evil of all that's done under the sun, that one thing happens to all. Truly the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live. After that, they go to the dead. But for him who is joined to all the living, there is hope. But for a living dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die. And the dead know nothing, but they have no more reward. And the memory of them is forgotten. Also their love, their hatred, their envy, even have now perished. Nevermore will they have a share in anything that is done under the sun. You know, the one great limitation that hangs over all of our heads is that we're going to die, and you and I do not know when. Chapter 7 of this great book says in verse number 2, just back up a couple chapters, I often pondered this verse. Solomon says, it's better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting. For that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart. You know, many of us, at least some of us, will be going to houses of mourning. We'll be going to funerals from time to time throughout our life. And you know something? You won't experience the same thing in a house of feasting as you do in a house of mourning. When's the last time you came back from a party? And I'm all for having a good time at a party. But when's the last time you went to a party when there was great friends, a lot of smiles, good food, good things to drink, good stout cup of coffee for me, and you come back from that with a greater resolve to live for God? That doesn't happen at a fun party, but it does happen at a funeral. We're all going to die and we don't know when, and it's the one great thing that brings disillusionment to all of us. And chapter 9, verses 11 and 12 state the following. Solomon says the following. He says, I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, and the battle is not to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill, but time and chance happen to them all. For man does not know his time. Like a fish taken in a cruel net, Like birds caught in a snare, so the sons of men are snared in an evil time when it falls suddenly upon them. Time and chance will happen to all of us. You know, I used to like to use this. Brandon and BJ, when they were little, we used to go see the California Angels. Now, this was back in the day when they just had a terrible team. I think some of the high school teams could have beat them. And we would sit there and watch them just get pummeled all the time. And I used to always think, time and chance happened to us all. You know, they'd always either beat themselves or just get completely clobbered. But time and chance does happen. Time and chance happens to everybody. And what this verse is really saying in verse 12, and is that the good life is not the product of you having a natural advantage. It's the product of a mind that has been set free from selfish ambitions when everything else is put in God's perspective, and we don't know when we're going to pass from this life onto the next, and that we know we have got to be prepared, and we are prepared. You see, time and chance happen to all of us. Our lives are in the hands of God, and therefore there's got to be a meeting of the mind, a meeting of God's mind with a meeting with man's mind. And you know, Solomon's problem earlier in the earlier part of this book, he works solo on a lot of these problems and issues that can only be understood when you put God back in the picture, when you have divine help and divine revelation. He tries to push a God aside, at least temporarily or partially, and you can't really do that and truly be happy and fulfilled and understand what life is all about. You know, when we face these physical and spiritual destitutes of life, there is a way that oftentimes seems right to a man, but that way, when it's divorced from divine guidance, always leads to trouble. The genuine good life, then, will seek God's will as his first priority, and then knows by faith that God has accepted what we have to offer. With deep humility, profound diligence to submit our will to God's, we can understand and we can know by faith, and even our most feeble efforts, no matter how small they are in our own eyes, are efforts that God knows about, efforts that God cares about, and efforts that God has accepted. And that is exactly what he's talking about back in our text in verses 7 and 8. Let's read that. He says, "Go eat now your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. Let your garments always be white, and let your head lack no oil. See, what this passage tells us is that God is smiling on our life. You see, with God as the foundation of your life, with God as the foundation of one's life, we finally come to the end of this great book in chapter 12, verses 13 and 14, when he says, let's hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether it is good or whether it is evil. You know, when we realize that and we put this into practice to the nth degree, when we're obedient to the gospel of Christ, when we know that we're doing all that we physically can to do that which is right, and God has been the foundation of our lives, then you can look back, and instead of taking inventory like the rich fool did in Luke chapter 12, we can take inventory of our life with another sort of inventory, and it's an inventory that includes God in the picture, with God as the foundation. And the blessings are much, much sweeter. You can go and eat, drink with happiness and a cheerful heart. The preacher says, and Solomon calls himself the preacher here in the book of Ecclesiastes. He says, go eat and drink. Now, he's not talking about revelry here. He's not talking about getting drunk. He says, in essence, you can go out and do the most mundane things in life, just the simple things of eating and drinking with others. You can do that with joy and with vigor because you know God is smiling on your life. Henry Fonda, when he died a few years ago, before he died, said on his deathbed, and his wife conveyed this to the New York Times and the public, quote, "All he wants to do is to be healthy enough to go out and to walk in the streets of New York and to walk around." Now, that's not anything fantastic for a man of Henry Fonda's stature. You'd think he'd want to do something fantastic, especially as a man who had as many experiences in life. But all he wanted to do was to go out and be healthy enough to go out and walk in the streets of New York City. When God is the foundation of your life, hear me on this. When God is the foundation of your life, you can go out and walk the streets of Salem, and it'll give you a whole different perspective than when you leave God out of the picture. A whole different perspective. And even the most mundane things in life, the simple things in life, just eating and drinking with friends, can be done full of vigor and strength and happiness, knowing that God is smiling on your life, and that's what life is all about. With God as the foundation, the blessings are sweeter, and secondly, the home is much happier. Look at verse number 9 of this chapter. He says, live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which is given you under the sun, all your days of vanity, for that is your portion in life, and in the labor in which you perform under the sun. God says that foundation and that blessing is sweeter when you have a home. And verse 9 says there are sweeter blessings, a happier home. And notice the assumption of love here, folks. It says the wife whom you've loved. Someone might say, well, what about the wife you hate? That's not even under consideration here. The assumption of love is put there. This is your reward. This is your portion. He said, and what a grand portion that is. Who can find a worthy woman, for her price is far above rubies? Proverbs 31 and verse 10. But you know, the art to building a lasting marriage adds a wonderful quality to something that might otherwise be a very dismal life under the sun. And when you've got that someone special that you're working with, because that someone special, that he or that she is also trying to serve God just as you are, thank God. And in all probability, if that union leads to children and you begin to build a home, thank your God. Psalms 127 talks about that. Let's flip back there for just a moment. Psalms 127, I'd like to take a look at verse number 1. The proverb writer says in 127:1, he says, unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. He says, unless the Lord builds that house, they labor in vain to build it. But the psalmist here isn't talking about building just a mere physical structure. He's not talking about this drywall that this building is made of and wood and nails and 2x4s. That's a house. He's talking about building a home. And what a grand difference there is between the two. Verse number 2, he says in Psalms 127, it is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, for he gives his beloved sleep. Psalmist says here that God will provide even when your head is on your pillow at night. Don't worry about the things of this life. Get your priorities back in order. Let's look at verses 3 through 5 of this psalm. Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are children of one's youth. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with their enemies at the gate. Kelly and I have been very blessed to have a couple arrows in our quiver, having Brandon and BJ, and what a blessing they have been as we watch them grow through each chapter of their life, because we're going through different chapters of our life as well as parents. And with God as the foundation of the Sipe home, it's a very, very special thing. It has to be. It ought to be. I like to use children's books in a lot of my sermons. And I was very impressed with this one. I'd like to share it with you this morning. I think I've used this maybe a few years ago. But the book is entitled Love You Forever by Robert Munch and illustrated by Sheila McGraw. Firefly Books is the publisher. In any case, you might be interested in buying it. I'd like to read that book to you this morning. It talks about the good life. Mother held her new baby and rocked him very slowly back and forth, And while she held him, she's saying, I love you forever. I like you for always. As long as I'm living, my baby you'll be. Well, the baby grew. He grew and he grew and he grew and he grew until he was 2 years old, and he ran all around the house and he pulled all the books out of the shelves and he pulled all the food out of the refrigerator and took his mother's watch and he flushed it down the toilet. And sometimes his mother would say, this kid is driving me crazy. But at nighttime, when that two-year-old was quiet, she opened the door to his room, crawled across that floor and looked up to his side of the bed. And if he was really asleep, she picked him up and rocked him back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And while she rocked him, she sang, I'll love you forever. I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my baby you'll be. Well, the boy grew. He grew and he grew and he grew and he grew until he was 9 years old, and he never wanted to come in for dinner. And he never wanted to take a bath. And when his grandmother visited, he always said bad words. Sometimes his mother wanted to sell him to the zoo. But at nighttime, when he was asleep, the mother quietly opened the door of his room and crawled across the floor and looked over at the side of the bed. And if he was really asleep, she picked him up. And she picked up that nine-year-old boy and rocked him back and forth, back and forth, and back and forth. And while she rocked him, she sang, I'll love you forever. I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my baby you'll be. Well, the boy grew. He grew and he grew and he grew and he grew until he was a teenager. And he had strange friends and he wore strange clothes and he listened to strange music. And sometimes the mother felt like she was in a zoo. But at nighttime, when that teenager was asleep, the mother opened the door of his room and crawled across that floor and looked up over the side of the bed. And if he was really asleep, she picked up that great big boy and she rocked him back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And while she rocked him, she sang, I'll love you forever. I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my baby you'll be. Well, that teenager grew and he grew and he grew and he grew and he grew until he was a grown-up man. And he left home and he got a house across town. But sometimes, on dark nights, the mother got into her own car and drove across town, and if all the lights in her son's house were out, she opened his bedroom window and crawled across the floor and looked up over the side of his bed. As that great big man was really asleep, she picked him up and rocked him back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And while she rocked him, she sang, I love you forever, I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my baby you'll be. Well, that mother, she got older. She got older and older and older. And one day she called up her son and she said, you better see me because I'm very old and sick. And so her son came to see her. And when he came in the door, she tried to sing the song. She sang, I'll love you forever, I'll like you for always. But she couldn't finish because she was too old and too sick. And so that son went to his mother and he picked her up and he rocked her back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And he sang the song, I'll love you forever, I like you for always. As long as I'm living, my mommy you'll be. And when the son came home that night, he stood for a long time at the top of the stairs. And then he went into the room where his very new baby daughter was sleeping. And he picked her up in his arms and very slowly rocked her back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And while he rocked her, he sang, I'll love you forever, I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my baby you'll be. That's what the good life's all about. And there's a perception on this that I'd like to leave you, and that is a generation comes and a generation goes, as Solomon says in chapter 1. And even though there's a very sad part of the story, and that is the mother grows old, and you know she's going to die. Ecclesiastes 9 says that death is dear every one of us. But the gospel of Jesus Christ says there is a life to come if we're prepared for it. And what's even better, we have a heavenly Father who wants to take us into his arms, and he will never, ever, never grow old. That's what the good life's about. The blessings are sweeter. The home is happier. The work is more rewarding. The last verse of our text that I'll share with you this morning is verse 10. He says, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all of your might. For there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave in which you're going. You know, this verse ought to be posted, I think, in every school, in every factory, on every refrigerator, in every home. Because there's a mint of satisfaction in hard work, and there's great nobility in effort. Would you die a lazy person? Or would you die as a person who just did enough to get by? When you look back on the fruit of your labors and you take inventory of your life, will you see a job that's well done? Ask yourself that physically. Ask yourself that spiritually. Will the Lord say to you, well done, good and faithful servant? It's the good life. Put it in perspective. How many people want to dream, chasing that elusive thing that constantly they're not able to attach themselves to? We want to do something and then be able to say, now I can die. I remember thinking this when I finally finished graduate school after working full-time as an engineer at Hughes. You don't know when this life is in, and you'd better be prepared. And if you're prepared and you know that God is smiling on your life, and you know that you're prepared, then you can say, I wasn't going to say, and then you can die. But the truth is, truly, then you can live. That's the good life. It's the good life and Father in heaven that is willing to extend it to you indefinitely around His home and around His throne if you're prepared. And if you're not, we want you to think about these things and think about the good life. As we together we stand and sing the invitation song.